It was said that women were simply not capable of it, that they lacked certain qualities such as courage, the ability to observe, caution and presence of mind, determination and independence. So they were denied that. And these are all qualities that you need on the mountain. That's true. But of course it's not true that women don't have them.
That's the voice of Sibylle Campbell, curator of the exhibition Burgdi, Frauen im Aufstieg. And with that, welcome to the Glockner Gipfel. In this episode of our podcast, I join Sibylle Campbell on a visit to the Burgdi exhibition at the Grossglockner High Alpine Road Visitor Center on the Kaiser Franz Josefshöhe. We will walk through the various rooms together and hear about the prejudices the first female alpine pioneers had to contend with, the dangers they faced due to the dress conventions that were appropriate but extremely unsuitable for climbing, and what drove the women to become summiteers despite all the resistance. My name is Max Kugel, and I would like to take you on this exciting journey. And I hope you enjoy Austria's highest view. So today I am at the Kaiser Franz Josefshöhe in the Visitor Center, where numerous exhibitions are presented, including the exhibition Burgdi, Frauen im Aufstieg. Welcome to the Glockner Gipfel, and perhaps I could start by asking you to briefly introduce yourselves.
Welcome. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Campbell Sibylle. I am an art historian and I curate exhibitions.
Very good. Including the one we are currently in. It's about women in alpinism. And perhaps, before we go through the exhibition, one first question. Is there a starting point where you can say that women have begun to play a role in alpinism?
So, at least I don't know of a direct starting point. Basically, you can say that alpinism and the like only started after the Enlightenment in the 17th or 18th century, when the perception of nature changed and people began to explore the mountains, geologically and cartographically. In this case, it was exclusively men who did this. And then there were the first women who saw that it was actually nice to be in the mountains. And some of them are also mountaineers' wives, geologists' wives, who join them, who go with them, and then gradually discover the mountains for themselves.
And the occasion for the opening of the Burgdi exhibition, which opened in the year 2019, was the anniversary of the first documented ascent of the Grossglockner by a woman. Now, two questions. Firstly, is that even true? And secondly, who was then the first woman on the Grossglockner?
Mary Whitehead, a British woman, was long regarded as the first woman on the Grossglockner, and Anna Maria von Frey, a woman from Salzburg, was the first Austrian woman. And in the course of the research for the exhibition, in the course of the archive work, it turned out that this might not be the case, that it could very well have been a Sidonia Teresa Schmiedel from Heiligenblut or an Elizabeth Hanser in the year 1868, who noted in the Glockner book that she climbed the Glockner Peak via the Adlersruhe. She too was a native of Heiligenblut, and this is not so well known today. They were locals, not aristocratic upper middle class women, and they were simply not as well known and not as important.
And did the two local ladies quoted go up the Grossglockner for their own sake? In other words, for the purpose of climbing it? Or did they see any other purpose in doing so?
I'm pretty sure that they had the style to actually climb the Grossglockner. In the case of Sidonia Schmiedel, who told the story that she went up with some mountain guides, and they were allegedly only taken as far as the Kleinglockner, so that they couldn't claim that they had really been up the Grossglockner. At least that's how the story was passed on afterwards. And in the case of Elizabeth Hanser, it was probably just really a mountain ascent, in the sense of mountaineering is beautiful.
In other words, the male mountain guides deliberately did not lead her up the Grossglockner, so to speak, so that this domain would be reserved for men.
Exactly, whether she was really on the Grossglockner and the story was told afterwards that she was only on the Kleinglockner, or whether she was actually only led up the Kleinglockner, we don't know. So there is no direct evidence of the deed under quotation marks. But there is a writer who interviewed people who knew her and wrote it down and passed it on as a story.
Okay, all right. We're now at the beginning of the exhibition and we're going to go through it a bit. There are lots of information boards and we're going to describe a bit of what we see and talk a bit about what you can find out here. So, we're now here in the first room of the exhibition and I'm standing in front of an interactive map, as I would describe it. What can you see or discover here?
You can see the first depictions of the Grossglockner, in other words, the first paintings, drawings and engravings, which you can look at together with a map of the entire Alpine region. The point is simply to show that at the very beginning, the Alps were really seen as an obstacle. They were described as a death zone, and that this changed in the 17th and 18th centuries when people began to map the whole thing, to record it geologically, and of course to record the assault on the summit. The mail documents from the time are all very dictionally. It's very much about conquering peaks, about conquest, that you then always capture this in pictures and then hang them in your living room or in museums, in salons, to show where you've been and what you've seen.
Collecting trophies, so to speak, the summiteers as trophy collectors.
Exactly, yes. The women have slightly different motivations. The way men and women write about their summit experiences is very different.
But in general, you can say that over time, the mountain has gone from being an obstacle to a pleasure or an experience.
Yes, exactly. So you realize, of course, you also have better equipment, and then you realize that it is possible to reach the summit at certain times on certain routes, and then you write it down. And then, of course, your successors come and climb a new route or the old route. And so it simply becomes a self-runner.
Young people would say that it's a kind of FOMO or fear of missing out, so to speak, that you're afraid of missing something. If the predecessor was up there, then I absolutely have to go up there again.
Yes, exactly. And ideally a little higher or a little higher on the next mountain or faster. Or via a more dangerous route, a more dangerous gully.
Well, also typically male, higher, faster, further.
Yes, exactly.
In the second room, you immediately see a familiar face and a familiar name on the display board, Empress Elizabeth. The popular Sisi was also on the Grossglockner and left her mark here. Was it generally the case that mountaineering was reserved for the aristocratic and bourgeois circles of society?
You can certainly say that. Mountaineering as an end in itself was certainly only the domain of the upper class. In the beginning, this was the aristocracy, the high society of England, who were mainly on the move in Switzerland and then also ventured into the rest of the Alpine region. The bourgeois upper class, they were on the move, and then slowly women too, but here too only privileged women, women from aristocratic and upper middle class circles, who first of all had enough time, who of course also had enough money to undertake the tours, which were already financially challenging back then, and who could afford to practically take themselves out of society, because from the moment you really did it extensively, you were, of course, also partly outside the social norm.
And in the beginning, of course, it was reserved for men, because for them a tour across Europe was part of the education of a gentleman, so to speak, while women were more prepared for their domestic duties. But that changed a bit.
Yes, exactly. The Grand Tour was very important, especially for young British men. They went to Rome to see ancient Rome, ancient Greece, but also to the Alps, traveling, mountaineering. That was all a male domain. And women had to prepare for their domestic duties, their marital duties. At most, they were allowed to go on pilgrimages or read travelogues. And as I said, it was only gradually that some women dared to do so, to go into the mountains and climb up them.
And what's the deal with Sisi now?
Yes, Sisi had several aspects. On the one hand, she was very, very sporty. As we know, she was very concerned about her body. On the other hand, she went to the mountains so much to train her body. She set up her own gym in the castle, which many people were very suspicious of. Then she simply broke out of the imperial ceremonial, escaping to the mountains. She was sometimes out and about at night in order to remain unrecognized. And there is a very famous quote from her where she says that the forest doesn't hurt me. So that really shows that it was very much about escape. And she was really extremely athletic because she was also very fast. Some of the ladies that accompanied her fell by the wayside and had to be collected by the carriage that followed them.
And where was Franz?
Franz was at home. He was on the desk. Franz was known as the most diligent civil servant in his empire. He had a very strict, rigorous work program, sat at his desk from morning till night, and worked through many files.
Nevertheless, this place is called Kaiser Franz Josef Hohe, so he's probably been here before.
Both were up here, not as far as the Großglockner, but quite up to the Franz Josef Hohe. Sisi didn't get quite that far up, and at that time, most of the ladies were carried up and didn't walk up themselves.
There was already something similar to tourism marketing in the 19th century, and back then the mountains were presented as the ideal world and the antithesis to the hectic cities. But what was it like in reality? Was the mountain world really intact?
Of course, it wasn't as ideal as the city dwellers in particular would have liked it to be or simply talked it up. They came from the cities, went up to the mountains and just enjoyed it all as a holiday, as a vacation, you would say, today. In reality, it was a romanticized purity that was put there. In reality, for the people who lived there, who worked there, there was really no reason to climb up the mountains, to go up there. In other words, to seek out nature for its own sake. Of course, there have been women who have climbed the mountains, who have worked as dairymaids, as messengers, as smugglers. There were women who worked as porters. Of course, some were married to mountain guides who led the high society up there, and if the husband was ill, the wife would also step in as a mountain guide, and some of them, as we know from the sources, were also enthusiastic female mountaineers, but they were probably the exception rather than the rule, and they certainly didn't have the time to pursue this hobby more often.
Most women at that time actually had to live up to their role model of being a housewife and mother and, above all, a good wife with all her duties. How did these pioneering women find the time for their mountaineering activities, or were they not wives and mothers?
Yes, many of these women were actually not married or deliberately remained childless. Becoming a mountaineer as a woman really meant breaking out of convention. And Zenzi von Ficker, for example, said that it wasn't the mountain itself that was the most difficult thing, but everything around it. In other words, overcoming these social and societal barriers. And in the beginning, it was mainly British women who dared to do it. And for some of them, it wasn't just the desire to go up the mountain, but a really targeted escape from this so-called bland middle-class family life to get out of it. And Elizabeth Main, for example, says that I owe the mountains a debt of gratitude because they freed me from the shackles of convention. But she also says that she had to fight really hard for it.
Exactly. But here in front of this display board, for example, is the question, are you allowed to do that?
Yes, that was a heated discussion back then. So many men doctors wrote about it. Firstly, it's not healthy and all sorts of things, but that they simply denied that they were allowed to do it, that they should do it, and that they could do it. So that was also denied.
And what drove women to become alpine pioneers despite all these adversities?
It must probably have been the same reason as for the men, simply a love of the mountains. And perhaps a certain addictive factor afterwards, waiting for the moment when you realize you should do it and you can do it. And then you realize it's simply beautiful, and then you just don't want to let it go. As is often the case when you realize it has something and you can do it, you can manage it, and then you don't want to let it go.
Nevertheless, the fact that they did it was, of course, sprinkled with a bit of ridicule and malice in public. For example, I read that the press reacted to Henriette d'Angeville's ascent of Mont Blanc by writing that the proud mountain, Mont Blanc, should actually feel insulted by a woman's foot stepping on it. Was the public reaction always so derogatory?
Very often, yes. There are many, many examples. Another example is Anne Lester. She traveled a lot in the Pyrenees and actually had climbs confirmed by a lawyer because they were repeatedly denied. Then she went to a lawyer and had a document issued that actually stated that she had been up there, that she had reached the summit. Often she was actually the first to do so, before a man made the first ascent.
He had it certified and notarized because otherwise nobody would have believed it.
Yes, indeed. So those weren't the only obstacles afterwards. First you have the obstacle of getting there in the first place, and then you have the obstacle of being recognized. Or, for example, being accepted into alpine clubs. The first alpine clubs were founded back then in Great Britain, Switzerland, Austria and Germany, and most of them were denied admission. And there's a very funny example of Mette Prevor, who really was an outstanding alpinist. And she was banned from joining the male alpine clubs, but her dog, who she took with her, was accepted, so they gave the dog medals for the summit victories, but the woman was denied.
So women in alpinism have had to contend with numerous prejudices. Can they do it? Are they allowed to? And so they were also denied the ability to be companions, which is an indispensable part of high mountain mountaineering. You have to be able to rely 100% on the others in a rope team.
It was said that women were simply not capable of this, that they lacked certain qualities such as courage, observation, caution, and presence of mind, determination, and independence. This were denied to them, and these are all qualities that you need on the mountain. That's true, but the fact that women don't have that is not true, of course. The women didn't say that and then said, well, they often see courage in men as stupid recklessness or brash stubbornness. And sometimes men's presence of mind is just a happy coincidence and love for the cause. So they have tried to simply, yes, practically start a tit for tat.
With this display board, the prejudice, I can see a screen, probably a touch screen. Can we do something interactive there?
Yes, exactly. You can. So you first enter whether you are a woman or a man. And then questions are asked such as who needs more sleep? And then you can make an estimate, woman or man, and then you can immediately see what the answer actually is. And we have used prejudices from very different areas or picked out questions about common prejudices. For example, who is more likely to suffer from heart disease or who is more likely to be overweight, who talks more? It's always a typical prejudice that women talk so much. Do more men or women live on Earth whose brain is heavier? And at the very end, you don't just see your own result, you also see the result of all the previous players. So you can also see what the men were more likely to guess and what the women were more likely to guess and who was more likely to be right and who was more likely to be wrong.
Wow, that sounds exciting. Let's play that now. As a man, I'm just going to give it a try.
So I take pleasure in playing the interactive prejudice game in the Bergdi exhibition. Admittedly, I think I got most of the questions wrong, so I fell for my own male prejudices. But we can listen to a few questions and the sometimes surprising answers.
Who needs more sleep, women or men? I would say that I need more sleep. No, wrong. The crying smiley now says my answer is wrong.
On average, women need 20 minutes more sleep per night than men because women have more tasks to do and their brains are more complex as a result. This means they need longer recovery periods. However, this does not mean that women actually sleep longer. It just means that they need more sleep.
Who is more likely to die from injuries or poisoning in Austria? I would say men.
Yes, that's actually true. There is a really big difference. For men, it's almost 3,000, and for women, it's about 1,600 people. Though the figures come from the year 2017, probably not that much will have changed in the meantime.
We have played through the game with all the questions, but of course we don't want to reveal all the answers here, because we want visitors to play it for themselves. In any case, I think it's a real highlight of the exhibition.
So on the board opposite the wonderful game, There is also an information board where you can read that even doctors at the beginning of the 20th century certified that sporting activities were generally bad for women and not good for women.
Exactly. You can read that in publications, not only from doctors, but also from other mountaineers. On the other hand, it has never been understood that women voluntarily expose themselves to such dangers, and women have generally been written off competitive sport. It has been said that sport is a debilitating activity for women. The term dysfunctional gender character comes up again and again. The musculature becomes unaesthetic. That was also mocked. And a very important point was that people claimed that mountaineering alienated women from being mothers and that they would lose their female identity as a result.
And that this would make them a worse mother.
Yes, that was, of course, the conclusion of the whole thing.
Wow, thank goodness a lot has changed in the meantime.
Yes, we can be happy about that. Actually, it should go without saying.
We are now in the next room of the exhibition, and I see numerous pieces of equipment that you need for mountaineering, but also a screen where you can watch a movie about a mountaineer called Helmer Schimke. What's it all about?
Helmer Schimke was one of Austria's best-known female mountaineers. She is one of the most famous mountaineers in Austria. We were extremely lucky to receive numerous items of her equipment on permanent loan from her daughter for the exhibition. There is also a movie about her life in the exhibition. She was a very exciting person. She started mountaineering very soon. She secretly went out at night in Salzburg to scramble up a mountain and then lay in bed again in the morning. She then got married, and her husband was an enthusiastic mountaineer, but unfortunately he died in an accident. She was then a single mother of three children, was an architect, practically worked in a male domain, and then really did the unheard of thing despite being a single mother with three children and working. She continued to go to the mountains and really did a lot of extreme mountaineering, and she was very much reproached for it. Her husband, however, who had an accident, was not blamed for it. That was quite typical. Or it is often still quite typical today that people say to women, you have children at home, be careful. And to men, it is completely natural that they put themselves in such great danger.
Exactly. Skydiving and everything is not questioned any further. And because you can see so many items of equipment here, I believe that the women in particular not only had to struggle with the prejudice they faced, but certainly also found the equipment a little more difficult to deal with, as the men probably did.
The subject of clothing is an exciting chapter, and we have given it a lot of space in the exhibition. There were women who overcame conventions and climbed the mountain, but what most of them didn't overcome were the conventions when it comes to clothing. So they still wore dress skirts, wore corsets to scramble up the mountain and really put themselves in great, great danger. So they ignored one convention, but ignoring the dress convention was simply unthinkable for many of them.
Because they were still visible on the mountain and were probably not among themselves, but there were also men out and about, and they could probably have been seen.
There are several aspects to this. In the beginning, they simply wore everyday clothes. They wore long skirts with several petticoats or a so-called crinoline underneath, which was a hoop skirt. And then at some point, people started wearing leggings. But trousers were not only taboo. In some places, they were simply forbidden. So you weren't allowed to wear trousers at all. Now, some women did it this way. They set off from their accommodation wearing a skirt, put the skirt in their rucksack, and then continued scrambling with their leg wear underneath. Or they had skirts that could be gathered up, gathered together, or detachable petticoats. Then, for a while, people wore blouse pants, but they didn't really catch on. And then the mountain costume came into fashion, which was a bit tailored to the needs of climbing, but was still a skirt. And as soon as you went to the hut, you basically had to wear a skirt again. And if you were lucky, you were even looked after. But there were huts where women who were climbing weren't even allowed in and simply weren't allowed to move around.
We have a few skirts in the exhibits that you can see here now, including a petticoat or crinoline, which is relatively rigid and stiff, so to speak, to fluff up the shape of the skirt. Not only is it uncomfortable, but if you think about climbing, it's also quite dangerous to wear in the high alpine mountains.
In any case, dangerous not only for yourself, but also for those who come after you in terms of falling rocks. The lesser evil of the crinoline was the many underskirts, which were often made of a lot of methane. And there's the story of Lissy Bourne, for example, who lived in the middle of the 19th century and had an accident on Mount Washington because all her petticoats were soaked up by bad weather, ice and wetness that they weighed 30 kilos, and then she crashed. So, of course, you got tangled up in it, got caught in it, you caused a rockfall. So it was very, very dangerous, of course.
Yes, and now we've already briefly mentioned that, of course, there was also a lot more weight for the women to carry. And it's not just the clothing equipment that is extremely heavy to carry, but you're out in the high alpine mountains for a bit longer than an hour, which means you also have to have a lot of provisions with you.
Yes, of course, you also took provisions. There are really funny provision lists that list what you took with you. Of course, it wasn't carried by the mountaineers, by the aristocrats themselves, but by mountain guides or their own porters, including women porters, and it included everything from roast quail to champagne.
And also a woman wasn't always alone or rarely alone in the high mountains. And as I said, we've already talked about it, the tours didn't just last an hour. In other words, there were also stops in huts in between, even overnight, and that was not without its problems for women.
It was very problematic, especially when women were traveling alone. It was tolerated that the woman would practically go along with her husband, some with her brother, or with their fathers who were just mountaineers. But it was basically assumed that the women would humbly subordinate themselves. They were tolerated as charming companions. It was then taken for granted that the woman would cook at the refuge, that she would prepare the sleeping loungers, that she would tend to injuries, but that she was practically active herself. Possibly even alone, that certainly led to problems. So it could happen that she really wasn't allowed into shelters, wasn't looked after, wasn't allowed to spend the night there. And of course, if a woman was traveling with a mountain guide, it was a big issue that she might have spent the night alone with them at the refuge. So women were accused of all sorts of things.
Is it fair to say that the balance between men and women in alpinism, climbing, or extreme mountaineering has now been restored?
Certainly not yet in terms of numbers, because there are still incredibly few women in the profession of mountain and ski guide, for example. I would say that the numbers have certainly equalized a lot, where there's just a huge gap in extreme mountaineering, high altitude mountaineering, women like Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner, that's really only the very big exception.
We spoke briefly earlier about the fact that female mountaineers often had to deal with ridicule and malice. Now we're here in the last room and we have a whole display board about it.
Because it is very, very important that you are not forgotten and that you are recognized, that you document your own alpine undertakings. And the men did that in great detail. Most mountaineers have written books and given lectures, and that was hardly ever the case with women. On the one hand, because they weren't used to writing, because they didn't dare to write. So they may have done it, but they didn't dare to go public with it. So there are perhaps many more female mountaineers who were on the move early on, but about whom we all know nothing today.
Because they didn't actually want to publicize their success and didn't publicize it at all.
There have certainly been women who have written, but some of them under a pseudonym. Quite a few, for example, always signed their names with their brother's name.
What surprised you most about curating the Berg die Frauen im Aufstieg exhibition?
The aspect of clothing actually surprised me the most. It wasn't new to me that there were already women climbing mountains in the 18th and 19th centuries. But the way they did it, first of all, on the way, the difficulties, in terms of the conventions, in terms of all the things, but above all, in terms of the equipment. So you really have to take your hat off. You have to take your big, heavy hat off to the circumstances under which they scrambled up the mountains and dared to do it. That was actually the biggest surprise for me.
Very nice, Miss Campbell. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the invitation. It was very nice.
This was a new episode of Glockner Gipfel, the podcast of Großglockner Hochalpenstraßen AG. This time we visited the Berg die Frauen im Aufstieg exhibition. We would be delighted if you enjoyed it and would like to leave us a positive review on the podcast platforms, or if you would like to recommend the Glockner Gipfel to others. For more information, please visit our website at großglockner.at or send us an email to info@großglockner.at. Thank you for listening and hear you next time at the Glockner Gipfel.
This podcast was recorded in German language and then transformed to English with the help of artificial intelligence.